In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
Okay, we're going to finish William Appleman Williams, except for the last chapter, which we're going to get to at the end in June. The discussion of the second half of William Appleman Williams' Empire as a Way of Life will include insights from Chalmers Johnson's Sorrows of Empire, Felix Green's powerful critique of U.S. imperialism from the enemy, and Noam Chomsky's analysis of Cold War policies in Towards a New Cold War, among others. I will concentrate, however, on the World War II and Cold War empire policies of liberal democratic presidents Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John F. Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. Williams argues that the process of transforming the realities of expansion, conquest, and intervention into pious rhetoric about virtue, wealth, and democracy reached its culmination during the decades after World War II. Critical to our imperial self-deception, our surrender to doctrine, was National Security Council Document 68 of 1950, in which the United States asserted the unique right and responsibility to impose its chosen order among nations so that our free society can flourish. The NSC 68 authors presented the Cold War as the fulfillment or destruction not only of this republic, but of civilization itself. What humility. NSC 68 was, in Williams' view, the defining historical document of the Cold War era. Released in April 1950, its primary authors were two key members of the capitalist ruling class, Paul Nitze, former investment banker and head of the policy planning staff of the State Department, and Robert Lovett, investment banker who had been appointed Assistant Secretary of Defense. A key premise of NSC 68 was that other countries were to complement American objectives. This meant building a global world order harmonious with U.S. fundamental national purposes, a world environment in which the American system can survive and flourish. Translated into plain English, this meant a world in which U.S. interests, as defined by our ruling elite, prevail. The authors advocated a new world order to replace that which existed prior to World War II, and they recognized that even if there were no Soviet Union, we would face the great problem that the absence of order among nations is becoming less and less tolerable. Order in the interest of ruling elites has been fundamental to the nature of empire, and after World War II, the real fear of elites here has been revolutionary nationalism and independence in the Third World, not the USSR. Williams believes that NSC 68 is one of the truly imperial documents in the long tradition of Western European expansion around the world. He is right, and it is critical to understanding U.S. imperialism after World War II. It provides the benchmark for American foreign policies from April 1950 to our own time. Noam Chomsky's critical analysis of NSC 68 is found in his book, Towards a New Cold War, U.S. Foreign Policy from Vietnam to Reagan. Chomsky points to the serious problems facing the United States economy after World War II as the context for this document and its proposed policies. These problems included the fear of another depression and a special concern about an independent course in Western Europe. One critic called the latter, this independent course in Western Europe, a nightmare for U.S. policymakers. These fueled NSC 68's call for a vast militarization of the economy and the need for rapid and sustained buildup of the political, economic, and military strength of the free world. The free world, of course, is that part of the world open to penetration and control by U.S. corporations. The freedom the document advocated would allow the U.S. governmental and corporate class to dominate the economic and political systems of other nations. It had nothing to do with our common sense notion of freedom. Chomsky continues, the exaggeration of the Soviet threat reached almost hysterical proportions, even though the author simultaneously recognized fundamental Soviet economic and military weakness, a contradiction that is never explained by mainstream apologists of U.S. imperialism. The document sought to overcome U.S. domestic economic problems by the familiar device of military Keynesianism, what FDR used to end the Great Depression, with special attention, in one analyst's words, to overcoming Western Europe's tendency to pursue an independent economic course by binding Western Europe to the United States with military ties. This independent economic development might close off opportunities to U.S. capitalism. NSC urged the U.S. to foster a world environment in which the American, that is, capitalist system, can survive and flourish. This would not be difficult, given U.S. moral leadership in the world. As the author stated, the essential tolerance of our world outlook, our generous and constructive impulses, and the absence of covetousness in our international relations are assets of potentially enormous influence. Chomsky adds, or we might add, would be so if we could only somehow overcome the blindness of Latin Americans and others who, in their absurd and obtuse delusions, fail to perceive these fundamental elements of U.S. policies and actions. According to Chomsky, NSC 68 was a proposal awaiting the opportune moment for enactment that was provided by the Korean War. Its language was similar to the Resurgent America program of the Reagan administration, both in the manipulation of the alleged Soviet drive for world domination and in the real domestic and international goals concealed by Cold War imagery and rhetoric. Chomsky goes on to say, a decade later, the Kennedy administration moved to use similar rhetoric and programs, and their affinity to the Reagan programs of militarization and international confrontation and aggressiveness is striking. Let's return a moment to William's discussion of the benevolent and progressive policeman, I love that phrase, who is part of the self-image of empire. The real challenge to U.S. benevolence, he asserts, has always been the threat to the capitalist system posed by revolutionary nationalism, because any contracting out of the global marketplace threatened both the theory and practice of capitalism. The fundamental target after World War II, therefore, was not the former Soviet Union, but third world movements that would take those nations out of the global capitalist order. William's discussion of FDR's presidency is critical to his thesis on empire and a needed corrective to the largely positive view many liberals and leftists have of the New Deal. While it is true that the Great Depression left a deep psychological impact in the U.S., Williams is right that FDR's New Deal did not generate peacetime recovery, as the economy was revived only through World War II. The massive state subsidies generated by the war ended the Great Depression, not New Deal reforms. In Williams' view, Roosevelt actually strengthened the imperialist state. He steadily increased military spending and reinforced the power of giant corporations as power became more consolidated and centralized. And World War II, according to Williams, was a grand illusion predicated upon a failure to comprehend the full meaning of the Great Depression and grounded in the belief that the U.S. could reap the rewards of empire without paying the cost and without admitting that it was an empire. The centralization of power and imperialism that unfolded under FDR continued under Harry Truman, often portrayed as a liberal, anti-corporate political figure. Effective political power was more narrowly concentrated in the alliance of economic giants and the government that had been created during the Depression and the war, leaving citizens reduced to saying yes or no to choices defined and presented by others. Truman was a Wilsonian in his imperial foreign policies, who believed the United States had to be aggressive in getting exports and raw materials and relevant financial arrangements in order to ensure prosperity at home. An old argument. He and his advisors were hardliners during the Cold War and not responsive to any indications that the Soviets were interested in a peaceful settlement of the conflict. Williams' argument here that the United States was a major force in starting and deepening the Cold War is the thesis put forth by historian D.F. Fleming in his seminal two-volume history of the period. Williams believes the Korean War finally brought the empire to bay, causing Eisenhower to confront the essential truth about its ultimate costs. Ike clearly understood the inherent dangers of imperial policies, and in his 1961 farewell address, he spoke candidly and forcefully about the military-industrial complex that had become the axis of the American political economy. This complex is vastly more powerful today. Eisenhower's concern was ignored, however, when Kennedy and the best and the brightest empire managers took over. Williams views them as militant advocates of the global imperial way of life, who quickly reasserted their power and policy of policing the world in the name of benevolent progress. The New Frontier Gang perfectly expressed the psychopathology of the empire at bay and its consequences. Now, we will examine Kennedy's militarist and imperialist policies when we discuss Greg Grandin's book on Latin America. Williams tells us that the rhetoric became more apocalyptic, and Kennedy began a massive military buildup in the spirit of NSC 68. Even though the United States enjoyed a massive superiority in strategic weapons, he publicly goaded, even insulted the Soviet Union by gloating about its gross inferiority. In the early stages of the Kennedy presidency, the USSR had 4 operational nuclear missiles. The United States had some 20,000 nuclear warheads and 300 missiles. These and other facts ought to put to rest the lies used by Kennedy and his advisors that Eisenhower and Nixon, imagine that, Eisenhower and Nixon had allowed the United States to fall dangerously behind the Soviet Union in nuclear capability, one of the biggest scams of U.S. history. Kennedy's actions, according to Williams, scared the Russians and very probably led to the confrontation in 1962 over Russian missiles in Cuba. I believe Williams' assertion is wrong. The true context for the Cuban Missile Crisis is to be found in the terrorist acts against Cuba by the United States that eventually forced the USSR to arm that nation against a possible invasion from the imperial giant to the north. Williams sympathizes with President Johnson's brave and in the end tragic effort to rescue the contradiction in the imperial way of life. He tried to make major improvements in the quality of life for the poor and also secure the frontier in Indochina. He couldn't do both because the dynamics of empire left him no room for maneuver. U.S. imperialism, I would suggest, does not leave room for guns and butter. Each time that choice has been decided in favor of militarism that left domestic human needs to wither on the vine. Williams asks us whether the idea and reality of America is possible without empire? The short answer is no. Capitalist USA and empire go hand in hand. We cannot end one without ending the other. He continues, are we unable to share the world on an equitable basis? Again, no. There's not a snowball's chance in hell, given that this system feeds on endless growth and expansion and is built on a foundation of inequality. He asks yet another profound question. Is it possible to create and sustain a democratic culture without conquering or otherwise controlling and wasting a grossly inequitable share of social space and resources? Again, the answer is no. It cannot be done within the structural realities of a capitalist and imperialist system. I would like to begin our critical look at Williams with some insights from Chalmers Johnson's fine book, The Sorrows of Empire. Johnson, professor emeritus at the University of California at San Diego, a Japan scholar, and a former CIA consultant during the Vietnam War, offers a powerful analysis of the origins and true costs of our empire. Johnson's first major assertion is that most Americans do not recognize or do not want to recognize that the U.S. dominates the world through its military power. Due to government secrecy, they are often ignorant of the fact that their government garrisons the globe. They do not realize that a vast network of American military bases on every continent except Antarctica actually constitutes a new form of empire. An important aspect of this empire is that the Central Intelligence Agency has evolved into the president's private army to be used on secret projects, as, for example, in Nicaragua and Afghanistan in the 1980s. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Johnson fears that this militarism, arrogance of power, and euphemisms required to justify imperialism inevitably conflict with America's democratic structure of government and distort its cultural and basic values, that as this happens, the republic will be destroyed. The U.S. empire, in his view, has grown to the point where it staggers the imagination. It supports a military-industrial complex, university research and development contracts, petrochemical refineries and distributors, innumerable foreign countries with whom it has treaties, multinational corporations and the cheap labor they use to make their products, investment banks and speculators of all varieties, and advocates of globalization. The catchword that really means forcing all nations to open themselves up to American exploitation and American-style capitalism. Despite this complex and long imperialist history, Johnson claims we have a long-standing urge to find euphemisms that soften and disguise the U.S. version. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, professed to be not an imperialist, but an expansionist. Arguing for the annexation of the Philippines, he said, there is not an imperialist in the country. Expansion, yes. Expansion has been the law of our nation's growth. He was right. Just reread Roxanne Dunbar's fine article on U.S. imperialism to see the historical evidence for this law. In his discussion of the links between the Cold War and empire, Johnson claims that the former allowed the U.S. to grab a number of lands that were defended or liberated during World War II. In 1953, for example, the United States secretly forced part of the indigenous population of Greenland, a Danish colony since 1721, to move. It gave them 4 days' notice and threatened to bulldoze their homes in order to make way for a vast expansion of Thule Air Force Base, 234,000 acres, disguised since World War II as a weather station. Despite protests by the Inuit of Greenland and numerous lawsuits filed in the Danish Supreme Court, the U.S. remains in control of this base. For Johnson, the liberal Woodrow Wilson remains the godfather of those contemporary ideologists who justify American imperial power in terms of exporting democracy. Wilson stated, "The world must be made safe for democracy." America, he explained, must fight for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right, by such a concert of free persons as shall bring peace last free. According to Wilson, these were the pursuits we have always carried nearest to our hearts. What a guy. Grandin, in his book, details the historical record of Wilson's relentless imperialist aggression in Latin America, revealing the utter bankruptcy of the latter's claims that he was concerned about the fate of small nations. We'll get to that in February and March. Beginning with the Korean War, Chalmers Johnson tells us, the empire became institutionalized as huge military expenses fundamentally altered the political economy of the country. Staggering levels of military spending became a normal feature of civilization, and all members of Congress, regardless of political affiliation, tried to attract military contracts to their districts. Regions such as our own Southern California became dependent on military expenditures. By 2002, it was estimated that the Pentagon funneled nearly a quarter of its research and development funds to companies in California alone, a subsidy to major corporations that would have caused a catastrophic collapse of the state's economy had it been removed. The empire, with its Pentagon capitalism, turned Japan and Korea into political satellites in the late 1940s and paid off client regimes to keep them docile and loyal. Essentially, this means paying off the ruling elites in those nations to keep their own citizens in line. He continues, we have taught state terrorism to thousands of Latin American military and political officials at the Army's School of the Americas and utilized the CIA and the International Monetary Fund to bring about regime changes via coups, assassinations, or economic destabilizations, and have bombed or invaded countries that have openly broken with or opposed our hegemony. In pursuing these imperialist policies, Johnson argues, the most powerful tool of the Pentagon in promoting its image and protecting its interests from public scrutiny is official secrecy, the so-called black programs paid for through the black budget. This systematic effort to confuse and spread disinformation began during World War II with the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb. Since the beginning of the Cold War, the Pentagon has become addicted to a black budget way of life. All funds for the CIA were and still are secretly contained in the War Department's public budget under camouflage names. I like the use of the War Department rather than the Department of Defense. It was called the War Department until 1947. As the President, the Pentagon, and the CIA create new intelligence agencies, the black box expands exponentially. For example, in 1952, President Truman signed a still-secret charter creating the National Security Agency. In 1960, President Eisenhower set up the even more secret National Reconnaissance Office, which runs our spy satellites. In 1961, President Kennedy launched the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the personal intelligence organization of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of War. And in 1966, President Clinton combined several agencies into the National Imagery and Mapping Agency. The budgets of these ever-proliferating agencies are all unpublished and have not been challenged by either party since the creation of the National Security State in 1947. Despite the realities of imperialist aggression since World War II, built upon a massive foundation of taxpayer funds for overt and covert policies, the essential nature of the entire empire project must be kept hidden from U.S. citizens. Johnson points out that history tells us that an expansionist nation must at least attempt to disguise what it is doing if it wants to consolidate its gains. It must pretend that its exploitation of the weak is in their own best interest, or their own fault, or the result of ineluctable processes beyond human control, or the consequences of the spread of civilization, or in accord with scientific laws. Anything and everything but the deliberate aggression by a hyperpower. While we can see the blatant imperialism of George W. Bush in Afghanistan and Iraq, Bill Clinton camouflaged his policies by carrying them out under the banner of globalization. The main agents of this imperialism were Clinton's Secretary of Treasury, Robert Rubin, and his deputy and former president of Harvard, Lawrence Summers. The U.S. ruled the world, but did so in a carefully masked way that produced high degrees of acquiescence among the dominated nations. Johnson asserts that globalization policies must be seen within the context of an imperialism that cannot exist without a powerful military apparatus for subduing and policing the peoples who stand in its way, and an economic system for financing an expensive and largely unproductive military establishment. He believes we need to examine the elaborate ideology of neoliberalism that has obscured America's international endeavors before the triumph of unilateral militarism, and to reveal how militarism has displaced and discredited America's economic leaders. It is in this economic sphere that the overstretched American empire will probably first begin to unravel. That's his thesis. This is similar to scholar Emmanuel Wallerstein's major argument. The U.S. empire is in decline because of serious economic contradictions that must be masked with unilateral and belligerent militarism. Johnson makes a critical point about the connection between empire abroad and the destruction of democracy at home. It is an absolutely critical point. Although tyranny, because it needs no conscience, may successfully rule over foreign peoples, it can stay in power only if it destroys, first of all, the national institutions of its own people. This will first begin with a state of perpetual war, leading to more terrorism against Americans. It will be followed by a loss of democracy and constitutional rights as the presidency fully eclipses Congress and is itself transformed from an executive branch of government into something more like a Pentagon presidency. Third, an already well-shredded principle of truthfulness will be increasingly displaced by a system of propaganda, disinformation, and a glorification of war, power, and the military legions. Last, there will be bankruptcy as we pour our economic resources into ever more grandiose military projects and shortchange the education, health, and safety of our fellow citizens. I would argue that anyone who has studied the U.S. empire carefully would have to agree with Johnson's accurate and chilling analysis. From the creation of the national security state in 1947, the levels of lying, secrecy, and presidential power have continued to grow, aided by compliant and silent legislative and judicial branches. There are no checks on the endless war promoted by the empire, save for those that emerge from the people themselves. As we learn from the U.S. Vietnam War and the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we cannot count on our elected officials to mount any substantive challenge to the endless imperialist wars organized and promoted by Democratic and Republican presidents alike. As fine as Johnson's analysis of empire is, we must dig deeper yet to link U.S. imperialist aggression to the very premises and policies of 21st century corporate capitalism. In his introductory essay in his edited book, The New Imperialists, Colin Moores cautions us not to see the most recent U.S. imperialist actions under the current Bush regime solely in terms of a reaction to 9/11, or more sinisterly, as the pre-planned goal of bellicose neoconservatives. It is true that this regime is more willing to resort to large-scale military interventions than previous administrations. However, to see this as a fundamental change in the nature of U.S. imperialism would be an exaggeration. The USA has a long and unbroken history of imperialist conquest stretching back more than two centuries. While America is still the preeminent military power on the planet, its superiority and firepower vastly exceeds its economic supremacy. It is this imbalance between economic and military might that helps account for the shift to a more aggressive military posture. That's Moore's argument. It's very much like Wallerstein's argument. Thus, the drive toward a more coercive orientation in international relationships is intended to send a message not only to the so-called rogue regimes and failed states, but also to its major economic competitors. Moore believes we need to understand the move to the new imperialism is linked to the deep structural shifts in global capitalism that have occurred over the past two decades, shifts that are to be found in the neoliberal policies that truly emerged under Reagan and his successors, who attempted to address a persistent problem for capitalism, its tendency toward overcapacity and overaccumulation, an issue which is particularly acute for the U.S. economy. Driving this process was the need to locate new sites for capital accumulation and new markets for commodities. As discussed in Williams, this problem first emerged in the late 19th century and was clearly recognized by all of the major influential corporate and political leaders of that time. Moore believes we need to understand this latest and very belligerent phase of imperialism, therefore, in light of the goal of exporting and entrenching capitalist social property relationships throughout the world. It is about the universality of capitalism. And just as in earlier phases of capitalism, state military power has been central to the imposition of this new stage of primitive accumulation and enclosure. His conclusion, I would argue, is accurate and also distressing. We, and especially the victims of U.S. imperialism, face a more or less permanent state of warfare, war without end. This is necessary for the U.S. because its competitive struggle to dominate the global economy requires military action without end in purpose or time. In another essay in Moore's volume that complements and supports his thesis, historian Ellen Mixins Wood argues that the fully developed capitalist empire, which depends above all on economic imperialism, is basically the story of U.S. imperialism. Militarism is necessary in order to police the global system to make it safe for the movements of capital. Therefore, the first and most important objective in this new empire is free access for capitalism, and U.S. capitalism in particular, to anywhere in the world, what is euphemistically called openness. This free access to people and the earth has been obtained by the most violent means in order that exploitation by U.S. ruling interests will continue. In a previous class, I shared some insights from Felix Green's book, The Enemy, What Every American Should Know About Imperialism. I wish to add some of his other reflections to our discussions of Williams and empire. Green, writing in the early 1970s, I would argue his thesis is even more powerful today, argued that the U.S. had become the New World Colossus, the inheritor of inconceivable wealth and power. But, he asked, power to what ends, and where does the wealth go? Who controls this immense and complicated system? And is the U.S. using its new and extraordinary position to ameliorate poverty and injustices of the world? Or are we seeing only the latest of the long line of imperialists out only for themselves? Given the historical record, I would suggest that the answers to his questions are quite clear. Green argues that the maintenance of this imperialism became especially critical for the U.S. after World War II. In his view, therefore, the U.S. had to confront a number of immediate imperatives in order to save this system. One, it might be left as an isolated island in a world gone socialist, and thus capitalism could not survive as an island in a non-capitalist world. Therefore, the first survival imperative for U.S. rulers was to keep the existing capitalist world capitalist. Two, because of profits made during World War II, huge amounts of capital were accumulated in the hands of U.S. corporations. Capital cannot remain idle and will always go where it makes the largest profit. Therefore, it was imperative the U.S. invest surplus capital abroad where the largest profits could be made. Three, because of wartime expansion and the rapidity with which American industry reconverted its factories to civilian production, there was a growing unused industrial capacity. Therefore, another imperative was to find markets overseas for American goods. Four, in order to compete in the world market, it was necessary to obtain the prodigious amounts of raw materials at the lowest possible cost. Therefore, an imperative was to secure control over the sources of raw materials. Five, of course, in order to have access to the sources of raw materials and control over them, the U.S. had to have the capability physically to control those countries that supply them, thus necessitating the establishment of a global network of unchallenged military power. From the voluminous historical record, including D.F. Fleming's excellent history of the Cold War that he traces back to the U.S.-led invasion of the newly founded Soviet Union in 1918, not 1945, we know exactly what U.S. ruling elites did after World War II to deal with each of the imperatives that Green listed above. Green concludes his critique of U.S. imperialism with a profound question. Why are the poor countries of the world still so poor? And by the way, the latest World Bank and UN statistics show that they're vastly poorer today in relation to the wealthy countries than they were in 1970. It strikes to the core of the imperialist dilemma that few in the U.S. wish to confront. He says, foreign investment has not helped the undeveloped countries because it is not intended to help them. It is intended to make profits for investors, which is a very different thing. He concludes with what he calls one of the grotesque paradoxes of our time. The backward countries are enormously rich. It is indeed because of their wealth that they are colonized. That's the argument of Eduardo Galeano in The Open Veins of Latin America. We shall leave the final word on empire tonight to the eminent British historian Arnold Toynbee. Writing in the 1970s, he stated, and I quote, America today is the leader of a worldwide anti-revolutionary movement in defense of vested interests. She now stands for what Rome stood for. Rome consistently supported the rich against the poor in all foreign communities that fell under her sway. And since the poor have always and everywhere been far more numerous than the rich, Rome's policy made for inequality, for injustice, and for the least happiness for the greatest number. Just substitute the U.S. for that. Let's take a break. So, and let's have more of a free-ranging discussion because I don't know how long my voice is going
to
last.
Okay, well, there's no mention in William's book of what might seem to be countervailing tendencies, such as the development of the United Nations. And there, it looks like the United States is quite willing to give up at least some of its power by being a member of the Security Council, where power is shared with the other permanent members. And now I wonder how that gets included into your and William's analysis. Is it just something to be used as an imperial tool?
Because it's a good point. I don't know why he really didn't address that. I wouldn't call it much of a countervailing power. I mean, in terms of U.S. covert actions, and when we get into Grandin's book, post-World War II, and especially in Central and South America, the UN was essentially helpless to do anything about it, and the U.S. basically got to do what it wanted to do. Playing off of your question, even though he discusses the Soviet Union a little bit, I mean, it was the major countervailing power during the Cold War. I can't imagine the United States threatening Iran and going into Iraq twice if the Soviet Union were around. I mean, it would be inconceivable that the U.S. could do what it's been doing since 1991, regardless of whatever we may think about the abysmal, terrible policies internally in the Soviet Union. And we could spend decades talking about them, the absolute crimes, etc. On the international arena, they were a check to the U.S. Because I think we have a sense now of what the U.S. can do in the world, militarily, not economically. But that certainly is a failure of the book. Williams has passed on. We don't have him around to find out why. Because there have been, within a number of agencies of the United Nations, certainly it has done some marvelous work. And I think potentially it's the only institution on the planet in which there's any hope of some kind of what we would call a real world order, not the kind of new world order that Bush's father talked about.
Point. That seemed to be the hope right after World War II as well. And the United States was very strong in promoting the United Nations. So what happened? I mean, maybe it was that tendency was overcome by imperialistic tendencies, perhaps afterward or latent all along, but it does look like a kind of counter tendency that emerged just for a moment at any rate.
Yeah, and think of the role of Eleanor Roosevelt in working for the UN Declaration on Human Rights, which was finally approved in 1948. It may not be a great institution, but it's the only one around that we've got to work with.
I think we should talk about the limits to American military power and economic power.
We found
an insurgency in Iraq has limited and tied up the most powerful army in the world, just as a small group of determined peasants with low-tech military equipment did in Vietnam. And we now have the empire crumbling in Latin America because the power of the United States is limited in terms of expressing its total hegemony over those regimes. And the people, the voters in those places, have been emboldened to the place where they're electing socialist, open socialist representatives.
In laying out a critique of imperialism and recognizing the power of the U.S., especially since 1945, I think we have to recognize what Brian has said. Even beginning in 1945, I mean, there's resistance to the empire throughout the world. I'm just finishing now a book I've been meaning to read for a long time, more than 20 years, Seymour Hersh's book on Kissinger called The Price of Power. If there ever was a relentless journalist to equal Seymour Hersh in U.S. history, I don't know who it is, maybe I.F. Stone, but the long discussion in that book about Vietnam and this struggle of decades and decades, well, going back centuries against the Chinese, brought at an enormous cost, at an absolutely staggering cost, perhaps, I mean, I've seen estimates everywhere from 2.1 to 3.4 million Vietnamese killed, holding the United States, denying the United States an outright military victory, preceded, of course, by the other major post-World War II struggle in which the U.S. was involved before now, that is the Korean War, in which perhaps 3 million Koreans lost their lives, most of those in the North. I remember having a discussion with a friend, a colleague at the college where I taught, who had actually enlisted in the U.S. Army after high school and was a grunt. He was an infantryman in Korea, he said, and he was in what was now North Korea. He said there was absolutely not a single structure standing in just mile after mile and mile. They unleashed then the B-29s, and it was the most devastating bombing. But even with all of that, because of the entrance of the Chinese, the United States was forced to a stalemate, and in Vietnam. And there have been amazing developments, very surprising and amazing, in Latin America, given that the U.S. basically had a free hand for decades. Certainly things are going on, and you know they're trying to undermine and overthrow Chavez in Venezuela. But again, to go back to Hersh's book, he's got amazing detail of what the U.S. did to Chile. The U.S. does not have as free a hand today as it did in 1970 to 73 in what it did in Chile. And a final comment, I'm just absolutely stunned that at least on paper and certainly in reality, the most powerful, technologically the most powerful military in the world cannot occupy and control two devastated countries. I mean, these are not major armies that the U.S. is up against. And if the U.S., if you were a believer in this system, you would wonder what is going on. We have thousands of planes, hundreds of ships. We've got about 1,400,000 people in uniform. And remember, of the 140,000 or so official troops, you have to add about 100,000. I've seen estimates, 100,000 mercenaries, contractors. So U.S. has about 240,000. But of those troops, it's usually a ratio of 1 to 6 or 1 to 7. They're not all out in the field, even though they're more out in the field than were in Vietnam. When we had 541,000 troops in Vietnam, there were maybe 80,000 in actual combat. Because, you know, there are people got to drive trucks, got to type memos, got to cook, etc. Now, that's all being farmed out. So there's amazing resistance in this country. I mean, the U.S. cannot even control the green zone in Baghdad. I mean, it's remarkable.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the antidote to capitalism and corporations and things like that?
Well, I think, the ending of capitalism in some kind of democratic, socialist, communal, ecologically sensitive society, to me, is the necessary but not sufficient condition in order to deal with not only the ability and power of, because it's not corporations as abstractions, but it's actual corporate officials making decisions, which they have been doing for a long time, but have become especially powerful after World War II. Whether it was Truman, who some of my family voted for Truman, my dad probably voted for Henry Wallace in 1948, but people were New Deal Democrats, and Truman was perceived as a give him hell Harry, fighting the corporate elite in the society and supporting the people against the interest. Most of his major advisors were all Wall Street lawyers and investment bankers, so beginning with Clark Clifford, who stuck around to end up being Secretary of Defense War for Lyndon Johnson. So that the ability of a small class of people to make the fundamental decisions, whether it's over global warming, whether it's over women's rights, whether it's over racism, whether it's where we invest our money, how we invest our money, unless that's broken, and we have both a substantive political democracy and a substantive economic democracy, unless that's broken, I don't think you can break the empire. And I think Williams' argument, well, not Williams as much as Green and Chalmers Johnson, they're going to give us endless war. I mean, and it's rooted in this system. If we were meeting next year and the campaign is underway, I don't care whether it's McCain, I don't care whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's Hillary Clinton. I don't think the two parties are clones of each other. I think people's lives in the United States in concrete ways are better under the Democrats than the Republicans in terms of Social Security and other matters. They're not equal to each other. But when it comes to maintaining the empire, just look at history. Just start with World War I and Woodrow Wilson, okay? That I would argue that in the 20th century, that the Democrats as warmongers and empire builders, I would argue the Democrats had a tougher team. I'll take Woodrow Wilson, FDR, Truman, Lyndon Johnson, and Jack Kennedy as my basketball team. Okay? I'll give you, Coolidge, Harding.
Slicker and smarter.
You know, yeah. I mean, I'll give you any five Republicans you want, and I'll take the Democrats.
What about Theodore?
Well, yeah, even starting, before Teddy Roosevelt. And again, the image of Teddy Roosevelt going up San Juan Hill, which he really didn't, as an ardent conservationist. But Teddy Roosevelt was a virulent racist and imperialists of the first order. I mean, it's not that U.S. presidents before that, because when we went back, and those of you remember when we talked, when we were using Zinn's book, this imperial surge really started under George Washington, okay, the first president of the United States. I mean, the original imperialist struggle was against the existing independent nations. We call them Indians, indigenous people who were here. But if you move more toward the real, the argument is the real U.S. empire and imperialism really emerges with Teddy Roosevelt and the Spanish-American War, misnamed, it was the Cuban War of Independence, the war against the Philippines. From then on, over the last, it's a little more than a century. That's why I love that quote. He said, there are no imperialists in the U.S., just expansionists. But he's right. He's right. I mean, the country has been expanding and expanding. It's like this big balloon, man. Just keep...
Are you saying you'd take Woodrow Wilson over any Republican?
No, in terms of imperialists, because I think the image we have, for those of us especially who grew up in democratic families or considered ourselves as we were growing up to be liberal Democrats or progressives, is that the Democrats were much more of the progressives. And there was progressive legislation under Woodrow Wilson, which he took credit for, but which was fought for from the roots up. But we were never taught the other side, same way with Kennedy, that we're talking about an aggressive militarism in the world. And I think when you look at Grandin's book, you're going to be staggered by the amount of material that involves John F. Kennedy, the early rise of the national security system in Latin America, which led to the death squad regimes in Guatemala,
in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Argentina, in Brazil, Uruguay, are all traced to the efforts of McNamara, of Kennedy, of Bundy. I mean, those are the real roots. It's not that nothing...
Not Eisenhower?
Well, yes, before, but I mean where it became so institutionalized. I mean, really begins with Cuba, you know, where Kennedy, especially after the U.S., and it was a U.S. invasion of Cuba. It wasn't Cuban exiles. It was a U.S. invasion, crushed at the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy has, frankly, crudely, a bug up his ass, among other things, about Fidel. And we have the documents, and I'm going to actually quote extensively from two recent volumes I've read just on Kennedy's foreign policy. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary because the mythology of Kennedy is so out there that even to this day, people who are progressives and leftists, it's, well, oh, if John Kennedy had been alive, whoa, you know, he wasn't Richard Nixon, you know, that miserable son of a bitch Nixon, ooh, God, and, you know, but it's incredible. And so Wilson, even FDR, and Williams has an interesting critique of FDR, Truman especially, because that's when the national security state starts, under Truman, and the attack on the left in unions. And the Red Scare begins not with Joe McCarthy in Wheeling, West Virginia in February 1950, holding up, you know, I got 200 names and dropped to about 12 at the end of the evening. It starts with Truman. And the argument made by some historians is you had to crush progressive movements in the United States in order to really have imperialism abroad. And that's why dissent here in the U.S. is absolutely critical to keep alive, whether it's in the Democratic Party, outside of the Democratic Party, because they can't do anything they want to do abroad if there's real resistance here at home, as well as what Brian talked about. The real resistance, of course, is what's happening in Iraq. So
I think that the U.S. established the U.N. as a vehicle to express its power and control the world, and some of the little countries are running amok, and they can't control them. So that's my take on the United Nations. It's not functioning the way we expected it to. We have to act like it's supposed to be a democratic institution, but we never intended it to be. It's like the United States itself. And as far as the resistance, because if you look at the history of these people, they're ancient. And Rashid Khalidi, I was trying to get the name of his book. He came to Midnight Special, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
They drove the British out. The British gassed the Kurds. They drove the British out of Fallujah. I mean, you knew it was going to happen. Everybody should have known.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people did.
But the other thing is, with the book, with William's book, I would really like to see, in addition to this political analysis, more of an economic analysis, because that would be where everything begins and ends. And just to cap it all, when we talk about minimum wage, I think we need a maximum wage, and then we would end all this problem.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think it was Franklin Roosevelt. And let me clarify, I mean, you know, there were many fine and progressive things came out of the New Deal, mainly because they were fought for by working people, by quote-unquote minorities. I think Roosevelt, at some point during his administration, proposed 100% tax on incomes above a certain amount. And of course, it was dramatically less. I mean, you're talking now about 70 years. And he was hated by some members of the capitalist class. Others who were more farsighted realized that he helped save this system. But yeah, a maximum tax so that, or maximum income, so that you wouldn't have this guy who just got dumped at Home Depot, he gets dumped and they're giving him $200 million as a buyout. Your comment, though, about Williams, I mean, he spends quite a bit of time talking about the power of corporations, the kind of system we have that is so productive. It's one of the contradictions. It's the most productive system in terms of turning out things. Forget about, you know, having homes for people. The LA Times had an article that they did a very systematic count of homeless people nationally, 744,000, which would make that community one of the probably top 20 cities in the United States. There are very few cities in the United States above 750,000. There are about 10 or 11 that are above a million in terms of the actual city population. So we have a system that's amazingly productive, that has hundreds of billions of dollars invested abroad in factories and in speculation, and yet, of course, it can't be invested here at home to produce the kind of society that technically we know we can have. So I think he discusses that.
No, I was talking more about the interplay between the politicians, the front men, and the puppets.
Oh, okay. Well, I would just disagree in a comradely way. I think some clearly are front men and are puppets. Some of the people I mentioned, like Paul Nitze and then Dean Acheson and Clark Clifford, are genuine members of the American upper class who go in and out of government and, quote, what we call private life. You know, they go to work for corporations, they come to work for the government, and who both hold economic and political power, and hold economic power even if they don't have, they're not in office. For example, David Rockefeller, who was sort of the patron saint of Kissinger. Kissinger worked with the Rockefellers. So it didn't matter. David Rockefeller didn't have to run for office. In fact, it may have been Zach. I think Zach told a story that, Gore Vidal tells a story that somebody, I think David Rockefeller, said to Nelson Rockefeller when he was going to come run for office, I mean, you don't have to do that. We have people to do that. You know, Nelson Rockefeller was involved in public service, you know, as far back as FDR's administration. I mean, he was very active and, of course, became governor of New York. And actually, it was under him that my university grew dramatically, the State University of New York. And he was known as a liberal Republican, but they knew the Rockefeller brothers and others in terms of their investments. They were powerful figures to make decisions to try to shape this post-World War II world to really create order, because if all of these little countries, forget about the Soviet Union, but after World War II, I mean, so the Soviet Union's out of bounds. The U.S. could trade with it, but they can't dump a lot of surplus capital and commodities there. But all these other areas, if they start opting out of this system, we choke on all this surplus. So that's why Cuba was so dangerous in this hemisphere. I mean, regardless of whatever you think about internal Cuban policies and freedoms, lack of freedoms, if other countries followed Cuba's example, as Venezuela seems to be doing, then they will make, it's not that they're going to refuse to trade with the U.S. I mean, Venezuela is one of the largest oil suppliers to the United States, by the way. So it's not that that's not going to happen, but they'll determine what's done in their country. It won't be determined on Wall Street or Washington. And if that happens, more and more countries, our economy's in big trouble. Big trouble.
I just wanted to get back to the issue of the United Nations. And I'm curious whether, looking back from, say, the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala, especially all the interference of the U.S. in Central America in the late 80s, were there any times in which the U.N. took issue, public issue, that had some effect, some impact on all the brutal,
the School of the Americas
type training and so forth? Were there any times at which the United Nations really stood up and confronted the U.S. on this?
Well, going back to Kit's point, I mean, there are two parts of the U.N. There have been consistent anti-American resolutions in various agencies in the U.N. and in the General Assembly on U.S. position in the Middle East. I mean, very critical of Israel, condemning the invasion of Panama, U.S. position on nuclear weapons. One of the latest votes wasn't the landmine treaty. It was something, there was a vote a few weeks ago in the U.N. It was 157-1. I mean, even Israel didn't support the U.S. So in the General Assembly, which has no real power, but it has important power in the world in terms of influencing world opinion. It's not an irrelevant body. In the Security Council, well, of course, remember, some of these actions of the U.S. were covert. I mean, nobody knew. In Arbenz, it was 54. And Arbenz essentially was, he would be like a New Deal Democrat, okay? And United Fruit, who's, of course, connected to the Dulles brothers, and Alan Dulles was head of the CIA, and John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State at this time when they overthrew Arbenz. And Arbenz said, well, this is what United Fruit tells us the property's worth, and so we're willing to pay you what you declared as your taxable property. And they went, quote-unquote, batshit. So the U.N. couldn't, that was covert. Of course, the Iranian overthrow the year before. I don't know. You know, I'm trying to think whether the U.N. has blocked. The U.S. went ahead, of course, with the invasion of Iraq. It would not have been able to get another resolution through the UN in 2003. But I think ultimately, especially now with this regime, it will do whatever it needs to do without the UN. I don't know, honestly, I'd have to go back and look at the record, whether the Security Council has been able to block any U.S. aggression, certainly in this hemisphere. But maybe there's somebody with the... It could be brought up. Yeah, Jack's got a good point. It could be brought up and people, well, we're going to condemn the United States for the invasion of Panama or whatever. Or if people knew ahead of time, we're going to block this. Well, yeah, U.S. has got a veto. So, yeah, think of it. Panama, Grenada, Chile. Most of the things going on against Chile were a secret, but were known, certainly in Chile and elsewhere.
I enjoyed reading this book. You know, it seems like every time they wanted to do something, they were very good at cooking up an excuse, you know, rationalizing something or provoking people, you know, like in the Philippines or in Cuba and in North Korea, they didn't even ask Congress to. And I'm thinking of all these different presidents. They all sort of did a lot of acting on their own, you know, without Congress or whatever. FDR did it in World War II also. I mean, attacking the Germans and doing all this stuff to provoke Japan, you know, that brought the public to think that we're being attacked when really it was something that we set up to make it look like we're being attacked. And so this brings us right up till today, which is, you know, we've got an executive power that's just gotten all this power. And Bush is saying that, you know, he doesn't care. He'll do whatever he wants to. You know, when 70% of the people don't want it, it doesn't matter. Some people think this is a policy of attacking Iran, that they're trying to provoke Iran right now, and that the Israelis will be provoked into using bunker busters on Iran now. If Bush and company just take it upon themselves to do this because we're in this position where we have $4 trillion of debt and all kinds of other problems, the only way the U.S. economy is going to survive and control globalization is to control the Middle East for the oil, the raw materials, and globalization to keep Russia, China, and everybody else from doing it. So
I think you were leading to a question about executive power.
Yeah.
That it seems to me, especially after I quoted some of the things from Johnson's book, and this goes for both Democrats and Republicans, that increasingly, especially since FDR, right, the last declaration of war voted on by the Congress of the United States was December 8, 1941, after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. There has been no declaration of war since then. There have been resolutions. Now, people who are elected to Congress take an oath to defend and preserve the Constitution of the United States. Article 1, Section 8 says very clearly, Congress shall declare war. It doesn't say Congress shall declare resolutions. The founders were very, very clear. And you're absolutely right. Under both Democrats and Republicans, increasingly, we do not have, remember we learned in school about checks and balances. We have three equal branches of government, and we have the judicial, and we have the executive and Congress. So here's Bush, who wouldn't know the Constitution if it kicked him in the mouth, saying that he basically can do whatever he wants to do. But here you have Joe Biden, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's a lawyer, and he doesn't know about the Constitution, because under the Constitution, Congress holds the purse strings. Congress can undo the resolution that passed in October 2002. Congress can do all sorts of things. There's the Cooper Church Amendment from the Vietnam War. There are all sorts of things that Congress can do. Money originates in the House. Bills, which same way the Congress can demand, now it's not going to be upheld by the judiciary, because they're part of this scam. Congress can demand that every bill, by the way, under the Constitution is supposed to be public. So we're supposed to know all the money that goes into the quote-unquote black box. Well, we don't know. So just being a conservative today and saying, okay, we have a constitution, we're supposed to have a constitutional form of government, you want to send troops into Iran, we already have troops in Iran. You want to do this, you want to have a war, it's a war. Then you declare the war, you vote for the war, you tax people, that's what you do. And that, I think, over and beyond the tragedy of all these wars and the lives lost, I think Johnson's point is the destruction of what minimal constitutional democracy we had is so frightening that whomever becomes president, even if it's a really progressive, decent person, is caught up in this institutional power and will act and cannot go to the deliberative body, okay? You could understand it maybe. You could make an argument. Someone attacked us immediately, and we've got to respond, etc. But that, of course, wasn't the case in Panama or Grenada or Iraq. So let's have a real debate. And if we should go to war with Iraq, we don't pass a resolution giving the president authority, which Congress cannot do constitutionally. The problem is, and here's the dilemma, no court, and certainly not in my lifetime since World War II, no court has blocked the ability of the president of the United States to act as he wishes on foreign policy. You have a totalitarian regime. The Supreme Court consistently refused to rule on the legality of the Vietnam War. Justice Douglas, William O. Douglas, was willing to do that. They will not touch it. Federal judges will not touch it. So there's no way within the system to stop what is clearly tyrannical power. And that's the dilemma we face as a people. And so that's why I'm saying, make Barack Obama president. He wants to beef up the military. And my argument is, for the ruling class, what more brilliant stroke could you have than make an African-American president who's going to go kill black people in Africa and other people in Iraq and Iran, and he'll do it. He'll do it. And a lot of liberals are going to roll over. Well, you know, he's for inclusion. His inclusion is killing people of color around the world. And I don't know the way out of that dilemma, because I'm expressing my frustration, but Laura had her hand up.
Hi. Okay, let's suppose that I am the greedy, capitalist, United States imperialist pig that I am. And let's suppose that endless war is necessary for my well-being. But is it necessary for me to win every war for my well-being? Or am I going to continue to grow even if I don't win wars? Maybe it is necessary to win. So how am I going to win? Do I institute a draft? Or would it be smart of me to be a little less greedy and maybe cut a deal with some European powers or with India and give them some stake in my winning a war? Or is that just impossible for the system to do? I mean, the system wants to survive, and I totally believe that there's some very smart people that will ensure that it does survive. Is their own greediness going to undercut them, or are they going to wise up and realize, well, maybe they need to spread the wealth a little bit?
I think yes to all of those parts of the question. I mean, we know from U.S. history that greedy people in power, some of them recognized that some things had to change during the New Deal for reforms, to reform the worst aspects of the system to preserve it. And it's not an abstract system. It's people in power who want to maintain their power. That happened during the Progressive period under Woodrow Wilson. It happened with the trust issue with Roosevelt. There have been times in this society that the worst abuses, child labor, it's the development of Social Security, women's rights, other kinds of things, had to be done in order to maintain the sanctity of the system. Now, when it comes to wars, I think it may have been that one article we read by John Bellamy Foster. Yeah, the U.S. will cut deals. The leaders of the U.S. will cut deals with the leaders of India, the world's largest democracy, where millions of people live like beggars on the streets, and who knows how many people literally starve to death in the world's greatest democracy, where they're untold millionaires. I just finished Mike Davis's book, Planet of Slums. If you really want to read a depressing book, you know, when you think of what's happening in cities like Mumbai and Jakarta and et cetera. So it's in the interest of U.S. rulers to cut deals with people there in China, Russia, and anywhere to maintain the system in which they all profit. But at the same time, certainly Felix Green and others would argue, they have to maintain our interests first. It seems to me to be pretty sensible that they would want to crush any kind of insurgencies that arise, that they would have preferred a quick war as they found in Grenada or Panama to what they're facing now, because billions of people around the world are aware of what's going on in Iraq. That's why the Vietnam example was so powerful. It gives other people in the world the incentive to resist as well. But they can't control that. I mean, no one can say no one. Wilfred Burchett, who wrote for The Guardian, predicted early on that the Vietnamese resistance would stop the United States. Noam Chomsky, of course, who was a vociferous critic of the Vietnam War, actually differs with other anti-war people. He argues the United States did not lose in Vietnam because it so devastated the Vietnamese society, ecology, that it's going to take generations for it to be repaired. But they stopped a complete U.S. victory, as we had in World War II. So that's going to continue. And, you know, since Vietnam, the U.S. has not picked a war with any country that could possibly give it the resistance the Vietnamese or the Koreans did. Yet there is a resistance in Iraq.
They thought they could, they didn't, but they did.
Because, let's face it, the United States maybe killed 200,000 Iraqi soldiers in the first Persian Gulf War. The U.S. led U.N. sanctions in Iraq, maybe killed 500,000-700,000 children, absolutely devastated that country. In terms of an actual battle between armies, there was never any question that the U.S. was going to win that quickly. But other people, probably Khalidi and others, knew that based on Iraqi history, that you were going to have a resistance.
Same in Afghanistan. It was going to
right, right. And it's,
absolutely.
And it may not be the kind of resistance you like or we like in terms of it being these wonderful progressive people, because some of them are absolute monsters if they get control of their own country. But that's not a decision that we have a right to make. You know, if people attacked this country, if the position were reversed, and there were lots of white Aryan monsters from Idaho and Wyoming resisting legitimately, we might not like those people, but they have a right to defend their homes. I mean, we can't say, well, we got to have a pure group of people who are going to resist. There's no such thing in the world. And it's going to continue. I mean, I don't know how it's going to end. Every empire has gone down, so I don't know how long this one will take.
Everybody considers this administration to be crazy, and I think there is a method in this madness. I think the key word now is oil. The earth is running out of energy, running out of resources, and this administration knows it. And they'll fight to the end to get this oil. What's interesting is, and everybody says that there's a limit to their power, I don't think they cannot take over Venezuela. And as you said, the difference is, if they go on Venezuela, what will be the reaction? They lose all Latin America, and Latin America is progressive. If, when they go to the Middle East, who reacts there? Who fights them? Fanatic Muslims. They can always demonize them. It's very difficult to demonize progressive forces in South America. It's very hard. The European already accept this lie about Islam fascism. It will be very difficult to convince European about South America, because even they know something about the history of American intervention. Now, I'd like to make another point regarding the Soviet Union. At the time, the Soviet Union and United States actually divided the world. There was a small Soviet empire and a big American empire. And they knew this is their sphere of influence, this is their sphere of influence. United States never would have reacted, never intervened when the Soviet crushed Hungary,
that's right,
or Czechoslovakia. Vietnam was another story. The Soviets never interfered in South America. The exception was Khrushchev when he installed the missiles in Cuba. And as he wrote in his book, my purpose of doing it was to ensure to withdraw and to ensure that the United States will never attack Cuba. And what happened eventually, he paid for it. The Soviet leadership didn't like it. The Soviet leadership threw him out shamefully because of what he did. But it was the only exception of the Soviet Union balancing the power of U.S. imperialism. And now another thing about this administration, the difference, I think, that because of the oil, because of the fear of shortage of energy, they're becoming, in a way, more aggressive than all other administrations. And a good example will be with Israel. All the previous presidents put some mild pressure on Israel to make peace with the neighbor, its neighbors, with the Palestinians. The Bush administration puts pressure on Israel not to make any agreement.
Yeah.
Syria was offered Israel peace, and most of the members of the Israeli cabinet were ready to accept it, and Olmert told them, Bush is putting pressure on us not to make peace with Syria. The same is about the war in Lebanon. Israel failed after 3 days, and Gondoliza Rice told them to continue.
Yeah.
Now they put pressure on Israel to attack Iran. So I think they are not crazy, But I think the fear of losing the oil is so powerful that the policy seemed very irrational to many people in the world.
Amen. Charles, why don't we let you finish up?
Two things. One, to go back to the United Nations, one of the ways the United Nations was designed was that it's hamstrung in a certain respect, which we're seeing in Darfur right now, which is that the way the U.S. empire has worked is that it's worked within countries. It doesn't usually work overtly against countries, and so it's not usually seen as an aggressor. It uses the own ruling elites within the country, supports them militarily, and uses them to crush the people of their own country. And it's written into the Charter of the United Nations that they're not allowed to intervene within the political affairs of a country, so they can't intervene in what could be seen as a civil war, only with an aggression between nations. Knowing that that's the way it was designed, the U.S. takes full advantage of that. And you could argue, I suppose, maybe that it was intended from the beginning in that way. The other thing I wanted to mention was that I don't know that this is true, but my cynical hat that I put on at times makes me look at this world affairs and think of it in terms that religions and nation states are really fictions that ruling elites use to police people of lesser means, to manipulate them in ways to their advantage. And they're working with each other across national boundaries. You can see this all the time. And as long as they can keep a war going and they're profiting from it, why end it? I forget whether it was one of your lectures, John, or in the movie Why We Fight, that somebody said that they went to Johnson. He admitted to them privately. He said, I can't stop this thing because my friends are making too much money. I want to stop it, but I can't because my friends are making too much money. And then Eisenhower's statement that God help the person who sits in this chair that knows less than I do about the military. And there's one more thing about the interconnectivity. If they're willing to see a war go on, as long as they can keep making armaments and selling them, making money off of that, and we need more soldiers, well, we'll lower the requirements. We'll institute a draft if we have to, maybe, but we'll give them $50,000 for college and then make sure they get killed in combat or disabled or whatever. And if they'll do that, then why would they not sell this country completely down the river into a total depression? I mean, I'm sure they can make money off of that too, you know? So I just don't see that it's conducive to look at it in those nationalistic terms anymore.
The concrete reality is we do live within a nation state. And I think one of the things I draw from William's book and other readings is that there's going to be resistance outside to the U.S. empire, whether it be in Venezuela, whether it be in Cuba. Now people are saying, well, you know, Fidel's very sick. Is the U.S. going to take advantage of this? Well, maybe, but you have an island of 12 million people, of which millions are armed. They have a modern army. They have modern planes. And if the U.S. thinks it has trouble with people in Baghdad, believe me, just try and take on the Cubans. This is not Panama or Grenada. But the real issue is whether the people here in the United States are going to become informed in order to resist the ideology and hegemony in order to block some of this. Otherwise, it'll be back to Orwell's 1984. There'll be endless wars, and that will continue. And this enemy, remember, used to be China, and now China is our friend, and then it used to be this. Iraq was our friend, Saddam was our boy, then he was a monster, he became Hitler. As my students who never heard of Saddam, in August of 1991 or 1990, the next month, they all knew Saddam was Hitler. Okay, a month before they entered that class, they wouldn't have known who the hell he was on the face of the earth. They couldn't find a rock on a map. So it's what happens here is worldwide in implication. Let's go home.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. the LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.